Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
And now a take on morality from Barnard College philosophy professor Cheryl Mendelson. In a new book called The Good Life, she takes aim at targets from left to right to the notion of being cool. Professor Mendelson, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
The full title of your book is The Good Life, The Moral Individual in an Anti-Moral World. Not immoral, not amoral, an anti-moral world. Why that term?
Well, because immoral means doing something contrary to morality, and many moral people often do immoral things. We all do. It just means doing something wrong that you yourself don't approve of. Amoral means without morals, but what I'm talking about is a hostility to the morality, a hostility to moral values and that whole way of thinking, that whole mentality. And I think you see that all over American culture right now. And it's a hard thing to cope with, and it's something that we need to be aware of and respond to rationally.
You describe two main forms of anti-moralism, one with no norms and an authoritarian anti-moralism. Want to distinguish between the two?
Yes. The type with no norms is the one that everyone already understands. That's the sort of thing that was denounced in the 70s and the 60s. That was hippies and drugs and all the rules are gone. We'll do whatever we want. That sort of thinking. And it survives in pockets, the graying ponytail and the rest. And then there is the authoritarian, what some people call, and I like to call it that too, authoritarian narcissism. Both of these are narcissistic, by the way. Ego is the ruin running power behind it. The authoritarian narcissist hangs on to rules, but does so without the inner sense that makes you able to use your rules properly, supplely, with qualification, sensibly, and so forth.
What's an example of that from contemporary public affairs?
Yeah, so how about the zero tolerance rules in schools? So that a child who really has done not much wrong but shows up in school with a plastic knife in his backpack and the teacher says, you're out, 3 weeks, you're gone, zero tolerance. Instead of saying, this is a pretty good kick, he didn't know that a plastic knife would be seen as a weapon. Let's have a good talking to, call his parents and call it quits at that. So it's rigid, it's black and white, it is utterly rule governed, and it thinks that morality is following rules in those terms.
You write about abortion. You take the question of the morality of abortion head on in a way that few people do these days.
Yeah.
And you...
Everyone's afraid to.
I think so. And you conclude that it's not murder, morally speaking, partly because the early fetus doesn't experience a desire to live.
It has no experience whatsoever. It's live human tissue, but it doesn't have what you might want to call a soul or a consciousness. It can't think, doesn't want to live, has no love, has no pain. To the extent that it acquires those things, morality says, watch it, that's a baby, protect it with
all
your worth.
That's a big debate, at what point the fetus starts to feel pain.
So morality's response to that is, draw that line conservatively, draw it early. Make sure that you haven't gotten even near the point where those qualifications of the fetus for human, as counting as a human life, would come into play. See, I go even further than that because it seems to me that if you don't do that, and if you say a fertilized egg is a person, or if you say a conceptus floating around the fallopian tubes is a person, then you've abandoned all the ideas that make it proper for us to care and protect our fellow man. Why do we care and protect for each other? Because of our desperate wish to live, because our lives with our lives that are conscious and feeling and connected to others are so important. If you think that kind of protection goes to a biological entity that has none of those qualifications, then you're back into voodoo. This is primitive stuff. This is magical thinking. It's not rational. And I make a big point in the book of saying that a certain whole person rationality is quintessentially what morality relies on.
And, of course, people, especially coming from certain religious perspectives, will say, no, that early fetus has spiritual value,
right,
even if they don't feel pain or desire.
I'm glad you said that, because when people think that and when they have those religious premises, which I respect, it does follow that the fetus deserves the kind of protection they want to give it. I wouldn't deny that. But the fact is that a lot of religions and a lot of people don't buy into those religious premises. And then the question arises, well, if they don't, can we force them to by law? And the answer is in the Constitution, no, you can't do that. You can't force someone to follow your religion. All you can do is try to persuade them. Maybe you have wonderful things to say. So persuade away, but stop forming criminal penalties against doctors and women who have to have abortions.
I've always wondered why Roe wasn't decided on religious liberty grounds.
I've often wondered that too.
But your section on that, I think, ties to what you were saying about authoritarianism and zero tolerance rules, because you end with the conclusion that angry denunciations of baby murder regarding abortion are another example, your words, of the way in which contemporary anti-moralism attempts to use the power of moral condemnation to undermine morality itself. So help us unpack that. Right. Using moral condemnation to undermine morality itself?
Right. So the pro-abortion, anti-abortion people use moral-sounding language against the pro-abortionists. You murderers, you baby killers, they go further. They sometimes, occasionally, murder abortion providers, and they harass women going into abortion clinics. So that's using the language of morality to attack people who hold a true moral position. That's how that works. And that happens over and over again. It started happening back in the 80s with the Moral Majority, announcing we're the party of right, we're the party of morality, and taking it all over and really confusing a whole generation of young people about what this moral stuff was all about, because they hadn't grown up with anything but that quarrel, which was very distorted.
Barnard philosophy professor Cheryl Mendelson, her new book, The Good Life, The Moral Individual in an Anti-Moral World. And I want to go on to something very different from your book, though it's your chapter that immediately follows the abortion section, called cool. You find the notion of being cool everywhere today, completely commonplace, but something that undermines moral thought and behavior. So what do you mean by cool?
Okay, cool is, everyone knows what cool is. This is an attitude of don't care. It's a sort of cousin to what a child does when he's been punished or defeated somehow, and he says, well, I don't care. It's a way of transvaluing, making something that was actually good into something that now is bad or vice versa.
And you trace the origins of contemporary cool to the beat culture of the 1950s.
Yeah.
You mean Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg
guys? I do. And they were fun, of course, but cool doesn't take you too far. I have a great epigraph at the beginning of I shouldn't praise my own epigraphs, but it's Leonard Cohen, and it's a great line. He's sitting in a village cafe back in the 50s when he said, when cool was just starting, and he wrote in huge letters on his paper placemat, kill cool, because he said it sets up a cold wilderness inside rather than one outside. He thought it was a dangerous mentality to become common, and he saw that it was.
And from there, through the hippies of the 60s, punk rockers of the 70s, do-raggers of hip-hop up to the present, and you write, every reinvention of cool targets ordinary people, who it represents as straight-laced, stupid, disapproving, timid, conventional, and hypocritical.
That's right.
The same middle America that had earned the scorn of the Beats back in the 1950s.
Right.
But Do you think they're all rebelling against no meaningful target?
There were meaningful targets. There really were smug, empty people in the 50s. And to rebel against that was, of course, good. But it was perhaps a dangerous tool to use to rebel against it. You see, because look at what cool is. It's an exclusive club. When you're cool, you're always setting yourself apart from another group, the geeks, the dorks, the nerds, the ones who aren't cool. It is cold, not warm. It is inegalitarian. That is to say, it's always trying to establish a superiority. And
you say it's cruel.
It's cruel because, you see, it resists the putting yourself in the other person's shoes. It doesn't have room for sympathy and warm and sentimentality.
Although cool is often seen itself as an alternative response to the prevailing cruelty of society, at different points on your timeline, yeah. Racism, Vietnam, materialism, inequality.
Yeah, that's right. Also, you might mention the Black Panthers and a whole lot of left-wing 60s people were in quintessentially cool people. I don't deny that people who have stood for good things have adopted this sort of demeanor. It's a style. It's a demeanor. It's mm-hmm. nothing further than that. And they've used it. Nor do I deny that in today's world, where this is all but universal, innocent people do it because what's the point of trying to sound different from everyone else? I do it. I mean, you just want to belong to the world. You want to talk the way other people do.
And if we associate that mostly with being on the left politically, you also write about contemporary conservative cool, South Park
yeah.
Republicanism.
Right, right. And these are they're back in the 80s with the moral majority when young Republicans first started appearing on campus with their bow ties and their pinstriped suits. There was a great deal of snickering and making fun of them. And gradually that all changed. And now when you go to the Yale Party of the Left, Party of the Right, you can't tell the difference looking at their clothes or the way they behave with boyfriends and girlfriends.
We have about 2 minutes left. In historical terms, you trace the origin of morality as a response to feudalism.
Yes.
First a psychological response, then a social one. I could certainly argue the Bible was concerned with morality long before feudalism. So why start there?
Because there's a difference between talking about the moral mentality that individuals can have, whether or not they belong to a moral society or a moral culture. And there's a difference between a society in which the moral mentality is so dominant that it transforms the institutions within it and makes them reflect moral values. So you'd want to say that the Western democracies, which had moral cultures, not just moral people here and there. I mean, the Bible's full of wonderfully moral people, but it is talking to a world. It's talking to moral individuals in an anti-moral world. And that's what I'm saying we face here now again. We used to live in a culture whose conventions reflected the dominance of these people with this moral mentality. Read John Adams' letters to Abigail. Read Louisa May Alcott. These people were a little different, and we could afford to go back to that a little bit.
What would it take to get out of anti-moralism as a cultural, you know, foundation today, in your opinion?
That's not going to be easy because these people are gaining too much. You see, if one of the main elements of moral capacity is egalitarianism and sympathy and mercy, you're going to run into authoritarian and other forms of narcissism who want a world in which wealth can be concentrated at the top, hierarchies and social ranks can be developed. And you see the rising of this all through TV and entertainment. Certain occupations are low class, and nobody hesitates to say so on TV shows, although it must hurt a lot of people's feelings.
Cheryl Mendelson, Barnard Philosophy Professor, author now of The Good Life, The Moral Individual in an Anti-Moral World. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Paige Cowett, and Alana Casanova-Burgess produced this program. Our senior producer is Megan Ryan. Leora Noam Kravitz, and Debbie Fountain, tag teaming at the audio controls. Follow me on Twitter at Brian Lehrer and Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Talk to you tomorrow.